would be a silver worker's dream. We've got such extensive dictionaries and we can trace the etymology quite clearly, so the bars would be wonderfully exact. But nobody thinks in Old English. Nobody lives and breathes in Old English. It's partly for this reason that the classics education at Oxford is so rigorous. Fluency in Latin and Greek are still mandatory for many degrees. Though the reformers have been agitating for years for us to drop those requirements. But if we ever did so, half the silver bars in Oxford would stop working. That's why we're here, said Rami. We're already fluent. That's why you're here, Professor Playfair agreed. Semeticus's boys. Wonderful, no? To hold such power by virtue of your foreign birth. I'm quite good with new languages, yet it would take me years to invoke Urdu the way you can without hesitation. How do the bars work if a fluent speaker must be present? Victoire asked. Shouldn't they lose their effect as soon as the translator leaves the room? Very good question. Professor Playfair held up the first and second bars. Placed side by side, the second bar was clearly slightly longer than the first. Now you've raised the issue of endurance. Several things affect the endurance of a bar's effect. First is the concentration and amount of silver. Both these bars are over 90% silver. The rest is a copper alloy, which is used often in coins. But the triacle bar is about 20% larger, which means it'll last a few months longer depending on frequency and intensity of use. He lowered the bars. Many of the cheaper bars you see around London don't last quite as long. Very few of them are actually silver all the way through. More often, they're just a thin sheen of silver coating over wood or some other cheap metal. They run out of charge in a matter of weeks, after which they need to be touched up, as we put it. For a fee? Robin asked. Professor Playfair nodded, smiling. Something has to pay for your stipends. So that's all it takes to maintain a bar? Asked Letty. Just having a translator speak the words in the match pair? It's a bit more complicated than that, said Professor Playfair. Sometimes the engravings have to be reinscribed, or the bars have to be refitted. How much do you charge for those services, though? Letty pressed. 12 shillings, I've heard. Is it really worth so much to perform a little touch-up? Professor Playfair's grin widened. He looked rather like a boy who'd been caught sticking his thumb in a pie. It pays well to perform what the general public thinks of as magic, doesn't it? Then the expense is entirely invented, Robin asked. This came out more sharply than he'd intended. But he was thinking then of the choleric plague that had swept through London, of how Mrs. Piper explained the poor simply could not be helped, for silver work was so terribly costly. Oh, yes, Professor Playfair seemed to find this all very funny. We hold the secrets, and we can set whatever terms we like. That's the beauty of being cleverer than everyone else. Now, one last thing before we conclude. He plucked up one gleaming blank bar from the far end of the table. I must issue a warning. There is one match pair that you must never, ever attempt. Can anyone guess what that is?
Good and evil?
Said Letty. Good guess, but no. The names of God, said Rami. We trust you not to be that stupid. No, this one's trickier. No one else had the answer. It's translation, said Professor Playfair. Simply the words for translation itself. As he spoke, he engraved a word quickly on one side of the bar and then showed them what he'd written. Translate. The verb translate has slightly different connotations in each language. The English, Spanish, and French words translate, traducir, and traduire come from the Latin translat, which means to carry across. But we get something different once we move past Romance languages. He began inscribing a new set of letters on the other side. The Chinese fan yi, for example, connotes turning or flipping something over, while the second character yi comes with a connotation of change and exchange. In Arabic, tarjama can refer both to biography and translation. In Sanskrit, the word for translation is anuvad, which also means to say or repeat after and again. The difference here is temporal rather than the spatial metaphor of Latin. In Igbo, the two words for translation, tapia and kowa, both involve narration, deconstruction, and reconstruction, a breaking into pieces that makes possible a change in form, and so on. The differences and their implications are infinite. As such, there are no languages in which translation means exactly the same thing. He showed them what he'd written on the other side. Italian. Tradurre. He put it on the table. Translate, he said. Tradurre. The moment he lifted his hand from the bar, it began to shake. Amazed, they watched as the bar trembled with greater and greater violence. It was awful to witness. The bar seemed to have come alive, as if possessed by some spirit desperately trying to break free, or at least to split itself apart. It made no sound other than a fierce rattling against the table, but Robin heard in his mind a tortured, accompanying scream. The translation match pair creates a paradox, Professor Playfair said calmly as the bar started shaking so hard that it leapt inches off the table in its throes. It attempts to create a purer translation, something that will align to the metaphors associated with each word, but this is, of course, impossible, because no perfect translations are possible. Cracks formed in the bar, thin veins that branched, split, and widened. The manifestation has nowhere to go except the bar itself, so it creates an ongoing cycle until, at last, the bar breaks down. And this happens. The bar leapt high into the air and shattered into hundreds of tiny pieces that scattered across the tables, the chairs, the floor. Robin's cohort backed away, flinching. Professor Playfair did not bat an eye. Do not try it, not even out of curiosity. This silver, he kicked at one of the fallen shards, cannot be reused. Even if it's melted down and reforged, any bars made with even an ounce of it will be impotent. Even worse, the effect is contagious. You activate the bar when it's on a pile of silver, and it spreads to everything it's in contact with. Easy way to waste a couple dozen pounds if you're not careful. He placed the engraving pen back on the work table. Is this understood? They nodded. Good. Never forget this. The ultimate viability of translation is a fascinating philosophical question. It is, after all, what lies at the heart of the story of Babel. But such theoretical questions are best left for the classroom, not for experiments that might bring down the building.
Anthony was right, said Victoire. Why would anyone bother with the literature department when there's silver working?
They sat around their regular table at the buttery, feeling rather dizzy with power. They'd been repeating the same sentiments about silver working since class had been let out. But it didn't matter. It all felt so novel, so incredible. The whole world had seemed different when they stepped out of the tower. They'd entered the wizard's house, had watched him mix his potions and cast his spells, and now nothing would satisfy them until they tried it themselves.
Did I hear my name?
Anthony slid into the seat across Robin. He peered around at their faces, then smiled knowingly.
Oh, I remember this look. Did Playfair give you his demonstration today?
Is that what you do all day? Victoire asked him excitedly. Tinker with match pairs?
Close enough, said Anthony.
It involves a lot more thumbing through etymological dictionaries than tinkering, per se. But once you've seized upon something that might work, things get really fun. Right now I'm playing with a pair I think might be useful in bakeries. Flour and flower.
Aren't those just entirely different words? Asked Letty.
You would think, said Anthony. But if you go back to the Anglo-French original of the 13th century, you'll find they were originally the same word. Flour simply referred to the finest part of grain meal. Over time, flour and flower
diverge to represent different objects. But if this bar works right, then I should be able to instill it in milling machines to refine flour with more efficiency. He sighed. I'm not sure it will work, but I expect a lifetime of free scones from vaults if it does.
Do you get royalties?
Asked Victoire.
Every time they make a copy of your bars, I mean?
Oh, no. I get a modest sum, but all preceding profits go to the tower. They do add my name to the ledger of match pairs, though. I've got 6 in there so far, and there are only about 1,200 active match pairs currently in use throughout the Empire, so that's about the highest academic laurel you can claim. Better than publishing a paper anywhere else.
Hold on, said Rami.
Isn't 1,200 quite low? I mean, match pairs have been in use since the Roman Empire, so how is it that we haven't covered the country in silver expressing every match pair possible?
Right, said Rami.
Or at least come up with more than 1,200. Well, think about it, said Antony. The problem should be obvious. Languages affect each other. They inject new meaning into each other. And like water rushing out of a dam, the more porous the barriers are, the weaker the force. Most of the silver bars that power London are translations from Latin, French, and German, but those bars are losing their efficacy. As linguistic flow spreads across continents, as words like sauté and gratin become a standard part of the English lexicon, the semantic warp loses its potency.
Professor Lovell told me something similar,
said Robin, remembering.
He's convinced that Romance languages will yield fewer returns as time goes on.
He's right, said Antony. So much has been translated from other European languages to English and vice versa in this century. We seem unable to kick our addiction to the Germans and their philosophers, or to the Italians and their poets, so Romance languages is really the most threatened branch of the faculty. As much as they'd like to pretend, they own the building. The classics are getting less promising as well. Latin and Greek will hang on for a bit since fluency in either is still the purview of the elites, but Latin, at least, is getting more colloquial than you'd think. Somewhere on the 8th floor, there's a postdoc working on a revival of Manx and Cornish, but no one thinks that's going to succeed. Same with Gaelic, but don't tell Kathy. That's why you three are so valuable. Antony pointed at them all in turn, except for Letty. You know languages they haven't milked to exhaustion yet.
Well, what about me?
Letty said indignantly. Well, you're all right for a bit. But only because Britain's developed its sense of national identity in opposition to the French. The French are superstitious heathens. We are Protestants. The French wear wooden shoes, so we wear leather. We'll resist French incursion on our language yet, but it's really the colonies and the semi-colonies. Robin and China, Rami and India, boys, you're uncharted territory. You're the stuff that everyone's fighting over.
You say it like it's a resource, said Rami.
Well, certainly. Language is a resource just like gold and silver. People have fought and died over those grammaticas.
But that's absurd, said Letty. Language is just words. Just thoughts. You can't constrain the use of a language.
Can't you? Asked Antony. Do you know the official punishment in China for teaching Mandarin to a foreigner is death? Letty turned to Robin.
Is that true?
I think it is, said Robin.
Professor Chakravarti told me the same thing. The Qin government they're scared. They're scared of the outside.
You see? Asked Antony.
Languages aren't just made of words. They're modes of looking at the world. They're the keys to civilization. And that's knowledge worth killing for.
Words tell stories. This was how Professor Lovell opened their first class that afternoon, held in a spare, windowless room on the tower's 5th floor. Specifically, the history of those words, how they came into use, and how their meanings morphed into what they mean today, tell us just as much about a people, if not more, than any other kind of historical artifact. Take the word knave. Where do you think it comes from?
Playing cards, right? You've got your king, queen, Letty started, then broke off when she realized the argument was circular.
Never mind.
Professor Lovell shook his head.
The old English knafer refers to a boy servant or young male servant. We confirm this with its German cognate, knabe, which is an old term for boy,
So knaves were originally young boys who attended to knights. But when the institution of knighthood crumbled at the end of the 16th century, when the lords realized they could hire cheaper and better professional armies, hundreds of knaves found themselves unemployed. So they did what any young man down in their luck would do. They fell in with highwaymen and robbers and became the low-life scoundrels that we label as knaves now. So, the history of the world does not describe just a change in language, but a change in an entire social order. Professor Lovell was not a passionate lecturer, nor a natural performer. He looked ill at ease before an audience. His movements were stilted and abrupt, and he spoke in a dry, somber, straightforward manner. Still, every word out of his mouth was perfectly timed, well-considered, and fascinating. In the days before this lecture, Robin had dreaded taking a class with his guardian, but it turned out not to be awkward or embarrassing. Professor Lovell treated him just like he had in front of company back in Hampstead. Distant, formal, his eyes flitting always over Robin's face without landing, like the space where he existed could not be seen. "We get the word etymology from the Greek etymon," continued Professor Lovell. "The true sense of a word from etymos, the true or actual. So we can think of etymology as an exercise in tracing how far a word has strayed from its roots. For they travel marvelous distances, both literally and metaphorically." He looked suddenly at Robin. "What's the word for a great storm in Mandarin?" Robin gave a start. "Feng bao."
"Feng bao."
"No, give me something bigger." "Taifeng."
"Taifeng."
"Good." Professor Lovell pointed to Victoire. "And what weather patterns are always drifting across the Caribbean?"
"Typhoons," she said, then blinked. "Typhoon? Typhoon? How?"
"We start with Greco-Latin," said Professor Lovell. "Typhon was a monster, one of the sons of Gaia and Tartarus, a devastating creature with 100 serpentine heads. At some point, he became associated with violent winds, because later the Arabs started using tufan to describe violent, windy storms. From Arabic, it hopped over to Portuguese, which was brought to China on explorers' ships."
"But taifeng isn't just a loanword,"
said Robin. "It means something in Chinese. Tai is great, and feng is wind." "And you don't think the Chinese could have come up with a transliteration that had its own meaning?" asked Professor Lovell. "This happens all the time. Phonological calques are often semantic calques as well. Words spread. And you can trace contact points of human history from words that have uncannily similar pronunciations. Languages are only shifting sets of symbols, stable enough to make mutual discourse possible, but fluid enough to reflect changing social dynamics. When we invoke words in silver, we call to mind that changing history." Letty raised her hand. "I have a question about method."
"Go on."
"Historical research is well and fine," said Letty. "All you have to do is look at artifacts, documents, and the like.
But how do you research the history of words?
How do you determine how far they've travelled?"
Professor Lovell looked very pleased by this question.
"Reading," he said.
"There's no other way around it. You compile all the sources you can get your hands on, and then you sit down to solve puzzles. You look for patterns and irregularities. We know, for instance, that the final Latin M was not pronounced in classical times because inscriptions at Pompeii are misspelled in a way that leaves the M out. This is how we pin down sound changes. Once we do that, we can predict how words should have evolved. And if they don't match our predictions, then perhaps our hypothesis about linked origins is wrong. Etymology is detective work across centuries, and it's devilishly hard work, like finding a needle in a haystack. But our particular needles, I'd say, are quite worth the search."
That year, using English as an example, they began the task of studying how languages grew, changed, morphed, multiplied, diverged, and converged. They studied sound changes, why the English knee had a silent K that was pronounced in the German counterpart, why the stop consonants of Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit had such a regular correspondence with consonants in Germanic languages, They read Bop, Grimm, and Rask in translation.
They read the Etymologiae
of Isidorus. They studied semantic shifts, syntactical change, dialectical divergence, and borrowing, as well as the reconstructive methods one might use to piece together the relationships between languages that at first glance seem to have nothing to do with each other. They dug through languages like they were mines, searching for valuable veins of common heritage and distorted meaning. It changed the way they spoke. Constantly, they trailed off in the middle of sentences. They could not utter even common phrases and aphorisms without pausing to wonder where those words came from. Such interrogations infiltrated all their conversations, became the default way they made sense of each other and everything else.
Awkward, Victoire would say, pointing to Robin, comes from the Old Norse Ofgur, which means turn the wrong way round, like a turtle on its back. Then Victoire must derive from vicious, not Victoria, for you are nothing but vice, Robin would retort.
They could no longer look at the world and not see stories, histories layered everywhere like centuries worth of sediment. And the influences on English were so much deeper and more diverse than they thought. Chit came from the Marathi chitti, meaning letter or note. Coffee had made its way into English by way of Dutch,
kufi,
Turkish,
kahve,
and originally Arabic,
kahwa.
Tabby cats were named after a striped silk that was in turn named for its place of origin. A quarter of Baghdad named Al-Atabiya. Even basic words for clothes all came from somewhere. Damask came from cloth made in Damascus. Gingham came from the Malay word gengang, meaning striped. Calico referred to Calicut in Kerala. And taffeta, Rami told them, had its roots in the Persian word taft, meaning a shiny cloth. But not all English words had their roots in such far-flung or noble origins. The curious thing about etymology, they soon learned, was that anything could influence a language, from the consumption habits of the rich and worldly to the so-called vulgar utterances of the poor and wretched. The lowly cants, the supposed secret languages of thieves, vagabonds, and foreigners, had contributed such common words such as bilk, booty, and bauble. English did not just borrow words from other languages. It was stuffed to the brim with foreign influences, a Frankenstein vernacular. And Robin found it incredible how this country, whose citizens prided themselves so much on being better than the rest of the world, could not make it through an afternoon tea without borrowed goods. In addition to etymology, they each took on an extra language that year. The point was not to attain fluency in this language, but to, through the process of its acquisition, deepen their understanding of their focus languages. Letty and Rami began studying Proto-Indo-European with Professor De Vries. Victoire proposed the number of West African languages she hoped to learn to the advisory board, but was rejected on the grounds that Babel possessed insufficient resources for proper instruction in any of them. She ended up studying Spanish. Spanish contact was relevant to the Haitian-Dominican border, Professor Playfair argued, but was none too happy about it. Robin took Sanskrit with Professor Chakravarti, who began their first lesson by scolding Robin for having no knowledge of the language to begin with. They should teach Sanskrit to China scholars from the beginning. Sanskrit came to China by way of Buddhist texts, and this caused a veritable explosion of linguistic innovation, as Buddhism introduced dozens of concepts that Chinese had no easy word for. None, or biskuni in Sanskrit, became ni.
Ni.
Nirvana became Nipan.
Nipan.
Core Chinese concepts like hell, consciousness, and calamity come from Sanskrit. You can't begin to understand Chinese today without also understanding Buddhism, which means understanding Sanskrit. It's like trying to understand multiplication before you know how to draw numbers. Robin thought it was a bit unfair to accuse him of learning out of order a language he'd spoken from birth. But he played along. Where do we start then? The alphabet, Professor Chakravarti said cheerfully. Back to basic building blocks. Take out your pen and trace these letters until you've developed a muscle memory for them. I expect it'll take you about half an hour. Go on. Latin, translation theory, etymology, focus languages, and a new research language. It was an absurdly heavy class load, especially when each professor assigned coursework as if none of the other courses existed. The faculty was utterly unsympathetic. "The Germans have this lovely word, Sitzfleisch," Professor Playfair said pleasantly when Rami protested that they had over 40 hours of reading a week. "Translated literally, it means sitting meat. Which all goes to say, sometimes you need simply to sit on your bottom and get things done." Still, they found their moments of joy. Oxford had now begun to feel like a home of sorts, and they carved their own pockets into it. Spaces where they were not just tolerated, but in which they thrived. They'd learned which coffee houses would serve them without fuss, and which ones would either pretend Rami did not exist, or complain he was too dirty to sit on their chairs. They learned which pubs they could frequent after dark without harassment. They sat in the audience of the United Debating Society and gave themselves stitches trying to contain their laughter as boys like Colin Thornhill and Elton Pendennis shouted about justice, liberty and equality until they were red in their faces. Robin took up rowing at Anthony's insistence.
"It's no good for you to stay cooped up in the library all the time," he told him.
"One needs to stretch one's muscles for the brain to work properly. Get the blood flowing. Try it. It'll be good for you." As it happened, he adored it. He found great pleasure in the rhythmic straining motion of pulling a single oar against the water again and again. His arms grew stronger. His legs somehow felt longer. Gradually, he lost his hunched over readiness and acquired a filled in look, which gave him deep satisfaction every morning when he glanced at the mirror. He started looking forward to chilly mornings on the Isis, when the rest of the town hadn't woken up yet, when the only sound he could hear for miles around was the birds chirping and the pleasant splash of blades sinking into the water. The girls tried but failed to sneak their way into the boat club. They weren't nearly tall enough to row, and coxing involved too much shouting for them to pretend they were men. But weeks later, Robin began hearing rumours of two vicious additions to the UNIF fencing team, though Victoire and Letty at first claimed innocence upon interrogation. "It's the aggression that's the attraction," Victoire finally confessed. "It's so funny to watch. These boys always come out so strong at the front, and they lose all sight of strategy." Letty agreed. "Then it's a simple matter of keeping your head and pricking them when they're not guarded. That's all it takes." In the winter, the Isis froze over and they went skating, which none of them, save Letty, had ever done before. They laced their boots on as tight as they could go. "Tighter," said Letty. "They can't wobble, else you'll break your ankles." And staggered onto the ice, clutching each other for balance as they teetered forth, though usually this only meant that they all fell when one did. Then Rami realized if he leaned forward and bent his knees, he could drive himself faster and faster. And by the third day, he was skating circles around the rest. Even Letty, who pretended to be upset when he skidded in her path, but who couldn't stop laughing regardless. There was a solid, endearing quality to their friendship now. They were no longer dazzled and frightened first years, clinging to each other for stability. Instead, they were weary veterans united by their trials, hardened soldiers who could lean against each other for anything. Meticulous Letty, despite her grumbling, would always mark up a translation, no matter how late at night or early in the morning. Victoire was like a vault. She would listen to any amount of complaining and petty griping without letting slip to the subjects thereof. And Robin could knock on Rami's door at any time, day or night, if he needed a cup of tea, or something to laugh about, or someone to cry with. When the new cohort, no girls, and four baby-faced boys, had appeared at Babel that autumn, they'd given them scarcely any attention. They had, without consciously intending to, become just like the upperclassmen they had so envied during their first term. What they perceived as snobbery and haughtiness, it turned out, was only exhaustion. Older students had no intention of bullying newer ones. They simply didn't have the time. They became what they'd aspired to be since their first year, aloof, brilliant and fatigued to the bone. They were miserable. They slept and ate too little, read too much, and fell completely out of touch with matters outside Oxford or Babel. They ignored the life of the world. They lived only the life of the mind. They adored it.
And Robin, despite everything, hoped the day Griffin prophesied would never come, that he could live hanging in this balance forever. For he had never been happier than he was now, stretched thin, too preoccupied with the next thing before him to pay any attention to how it all fitted together. In late Michaelmas, a French chemist named Louis-Jacques Mondier Daguerre came to Babel with a curious object in tow. It was a heliographic camera obscura, he announced, and could be capable of replicating still images using exposed copper plates and light-sensitive compounds, although he couldn't quite get the mechanics right. Could the babblers take a look and see if they could improve it somehow? The problem of Daguerre's camera became the talk of the tower. The faculty made it a competition. Any student cleared for silver work who could solve Daguerre's problem was entitled to have their name on his patent, and a percentage of the riches that were sure to follow. For 2 weeks, the eighth floor frothed with silent frenzy as fourth years and graduate fellows flipped through etymological dictionaries trying to find a set of words that would get at the right nexus of meaning involving light, colour, image, and imitation. It was Anthony Ribbon who finally cracked it. As per contractual terms with Daguerre, the actual patented match pair was kept a secret. But rumour was that Anthony had done something with the Latin imago, which in addition to meaning a likeness or imitation, also implied a ghost or phantom. Other rumours held that Anthony had found some way to dissolve the silver bar to create fumes from heated mercury. Whatever it was, Anthony could not say, but he was paid handsomely for his efforts. The camera worked. Magically, the exact likeness of a captured subject could be replicated on a sheet of paper in marvellously little time. Daguerre's device, the daguerreotype, they called it, became a local sensation. Everyone wanted their picture taken. Daguerre and the Babel faculty put on a 3-day exhibition in the tower lobby, and eager members of the public formed lines that wrapped around the street. Robin was nervous about a Sanskrit translation due the next day, but Letty insisted they all go in for a portrait. "Don't you want a memento of us?" she asked. "Preserved at this moment in time." Robin shrugged. "Not really." "Well, I do," she said stubbornly. "I want to remember exactly how we were now, in this year, in 1837. I never want to forget." They assembled themselves before the camera. Letty and Victoire sat down in chairs, hands folded stiffly in their laps. Robin and Rami stood behind them, uncertain what to do with their hands. Should they place them on the girls' shoulders? On the chairs? "Arms by your sides," said the photographer. "Hold still as best you can. No, first, cluster a bit closer. There you go." Robin smiled, realized he couldn't keep his mouth stretched wide for that long, and promptly dropped it. The next day, they retrieved their finished portrait from a clerk in the lobby. "Please," said Victoire. "That looks nothing like us at all." But Letty was delighted. She insisted they go shopping for a frame. "I'll hang it over my mantle. What do you think?"
"I'd rather you throw that away," said Rami. "It's unnerving."
"It is not," said Letty. She seemed bewitched as she observed the print, as if she'd seen actual magic. "It's us. Frozen in time, captured in a moment we'll never get back as long as we live. It's wonderful." Robin, too, thought the photograph looked strange, though he did not say so aloud. All of their expressions were artificial, masks of faint discomfort. The camera had distorted and flattened the spirit that bound them, and the invisible warmth and camaraderie between them appeared now like a stilted, forced closeness. Photography, he thought, was also a kind of translation, and they had all come out the poorer for it. Violets cast into crucibles indeed.
Chapter 10. To preserve the principles of their pupils, they confine them to the safe and elegant imbecilities of classical learning. A genuine Oxford tutor would shudder to hear his young men disputing upon moral and political truth, forming and pulling down theories and indulging in all the boldness of political discussion. He would augur nothing from it but impiety to God and treason to kings. Sidney Smith. Edgeworth's Professional Education. Near the end of Michaelmas term that year,
Griffin seemed to be around more than usual. Robin had been starting to wonder where he'd gone since he'd got back from Malacca. His assignments had dropped from twice a month to once to none. But in December, Robin began to receive notes instructing him to meet Griffin outside the Twisted Root every few days, where they commenced their usual routine of walking frantically round the city. Usually, these were preludes to planned thefts. But occasionally, Griffin seemed to have no agenda in mind, and instead wanted only to chat. Robin eagerly awaited these talks. They were the only times when his brother seemed less mysterious, more human, more flesh and bone. But Griffin never answered the questions Robin really wanted to discuss, which were what Hermes did with the materials he helped steal, and how the revolution, if there was one, was proceeding.
"I still don't trust you," he would say.
"You're still too new."
"I don't trust you either," Robin thought but didn't say.
Instead, he probed at things in a roundabout way. "How long has Hermes been around?"
Griffin shot him a droll look. "I know what you're doing.
I just want to know if it's a modern invention or,
I don't know. I've no idea. Decades at least, perhaps longer, but I've never found out."
"Why don't you ask what you really want to know?"
"Because you won't tell me." "Try me."
"Fine. Then, if it's been around for longer, I can't understand..."
"You can't see why we haven't won already. Is that it?"
"No, I just don't see what difference it makes," said Robin. "Babel is Babel, and you're just..."
"A small cluster of exiled scholars chipping away at the behemoth," Griffin supplied. "Say what you mean, brother, don't dither." "I was going to say massively outnumbered idealists. But yes,
I mean, please, Griffin. It's just hard to keep faith when it's unclear what effect there is to anything I do."
Griffin slowed his pace. He was silent for a few seconds, considering. And then he said, "I'm going to paint you a picture. Where does silver come from?"
"Griffin, honestly,
indulge me.
I've got class in 10 minutes.
"And it's not a simple answer. Kraft won't throw you out for being late just once. Where does silver come from?"
"I don't know. Mines?"
Griffin sighed heavily.
"Don't they teach you anything?" "Griffin, just listen.
Silver's been around forever. The Athenians were mining it in Attica, and the Romans, as you know, used silver to expand their empire once they realized what it could do. But silver didn't become international currency, didn't facilitate a trade network spanning continents until much later. There simply wasn't enough of it. Then, in the 16th century, the Habsburgs, the first truly global empire, stumbled upon massive silver deposits in the Andes. The Spaniards brought it out of the mountains, courtesy of indigenous miners you can be certain weren't paid fairly for their labor, and minted it into their little pieces of eight, which brought riches flowing into Seville and Madrid.
An understatement. A few short decades after Potosí's discovery in 1545, the Silver City had become a death trap for enslaved Africans and drafted indigenous labourers, working amidst mercury, vapour, foul water, and toxic waste. Spain's King of Mountains and Envy of Kings was a pyramid built on bodies lost to disease, forced marches, malnutrition, overwork, and a poisoned environment.
Silver made them rich. Rich enough to buy printed cotton cloth from India, which they used to pay for bound slaves from Africa, who they put to work on plantations in their colonies. So the Spanish become richer and richer, and everywhere they go, they leave death, slavery, and impoverishment in their wake. You see the pattern so far, surely?
Griffin, when lecturing, bore a peculiar resemblance to Professor Lovell. Both made very sharp gestures with their hands, as if punctuating their lengthy diatribes with hand movements instead of full stops. And both spoke in a very precise, syncopated manner. They also shared a fondness for Socratic questioning.
"Jump forward 200 years, and what do you have?"
Robin sighed, but played along. "All the silver and all the power flows from the New World to Europe."
"Right," said Griffin. "Silver accrues where it's already in use. The Spanish held the lead for a long time, while the Dutch, British, and French were nipping at their heels.
Jump ahead another century, and Spain's a shadow of what it once was. The Napoleonic Wars have eroded France's power, and now glorious Britannia is on top. Largest silver reserves in Europe. Best translation institute in the world by far. The best navy on the seas, cemented after Trafalgar, meaning this island is well on its way to ruling the world, isn't it? But something funny's been happening over the last century. Something that's been giving Parliament and all the British trading companies quite a headache. Can you guess what it is? Don't tell me we're running out of silver. Griffin grinned. They're running out of silver. Can you guess where it's all flowing now? This, Robin knew the answer to. Only because he'd heard Professor Lovell and his friends complaining about it for years during those sitting room nights in Hampstead. China. China. This country is gorging itself on imports from the Orient. They can't get enough of China's porcelain, lacquered cabinets and silks, and tea. Heavens. Do you know how much tea gets exported from China to England every year? At least £30 million worth. The British love tea so much that Parliament used to insist that the East India Company always keep a year's worth of supply in stock in case of shortages. We spend millions and millions on tea from China every year, and we pay for it in silver. But China has no reciprocal appetite for British goods. When the Qianlong Emperor received a display of British manufactured items from Lord Macartney, do you know what his response was? Strange and costly objects do not interest me. The Chinese don't need anything we're selling. They can produce everything they want on their own. So silver keeps flowing to China, and there's nothing the British can do about it because they can't alter supply and demand. One day it won't matter how much translation talent we have because the silver reserves will simply not exist to put it to use. The British Empire will crumble as a consequence of its own greed. Meanwhile, silver will accrue in new centres of power, places that have heretofore had their resources stolen and exploited. They'll have the raw materials. All they'll need then are silver workers, and the talent will go where the work is. It always does. So it's all as simple as running out the empire. The cycles of history will do the rest, and you've only got to help us speed it along. But that's... Robin trailed off, struggling to find the words to phrase his objection. That's so abstract. So simple. It can't possibly... I mean, certainly you can't predict history like this with such broad strokes. There's quite a lot you can predict. Griffin shot Robin a sideways look. But that's the problem with a Babel education, isn't it? They teach you languages in translation, but never history. Never science. Never international politics. They don't tell you about the armies that back dialects. But what does it all look like? Robin persisted. What you're describing? How is this going to come about? A global war? A slow economic decline until the world looks entirely different? I don't know, said Griffin. No one knows precisely what the future looks like. Whether the levers of power move to China, or to the Americas, or whether Britain's going to fight tooth and nail to hold onto its place. That's impossible to foretell.
Then how do you know that what you're doing has any effect?
I can't predict how every encounter will shake out, Griffin clarified. But I do know this. The wealth of Britain depends on coercive extraction. And as Britain grows, only two options remain. Either her mechanisms of coercion become vastly more brutal, or she collapses. The former's more likely. But it might bring about the latter.
It's such an uneven fight, though, Robin said helplessly. You on one side, the whole of the Empire on the other.
Only if you think the Empire is inevitable, said Griffin. But it's not. Take this current moment. We are just at the tail end of a great crisis in the Atlantic, after the monarchic empires have fallen one after the other. Britain and France lost in America, and then they went to war against each other to nobody's benefit. Now we're watching a new consolidation of power, that's true. Britain got Bengal. It got Dutch Java and the Cape Colony. And if it gets what it wants in China, if it can reverse this trade imbalance, it's going to be unstoppable. But nothing's written in stone, or even silver, as it were. So much rests on these contingencies, and it's at these tipping points where we can push and pull.
where individual choices, where even the smallest of resistance armies make a difference. Take Barbados, for example. Take Jamaica. We sent bars there to the revolt. Those slave revolts were crushed, said Robin.
But slavery's been abolished, hasn't it? Said Griffin. At least in British territories.
No, I'm not saying everything's good and fixed. And I'm not saying we can fully take the credit for British legislation. I'm sure the abolitionists would take umbrage at that. But I'm saying that if you think the 1833 Act passed because of the moral sensibilities of the British, you're wrong. They passed that bill because they couldn't keep absorbing the losses. He waved a hand, gesturing at an invisible map. It's junctures like that where we have control. If we push in the right spots, if we create losses where the Empire can't stand to suffer them, then we've moved things to the breaking point. Then the future becomes fluid and change is possible. History isn't a pre-made tapestry that we've got to suffer, a closed world with no exit. We can form it, make it. We just have to choose to make it.
You really believe that? Said Robin, amazed. Griffin's faith astounded him. For Robin, such abstract reasoning was a reason to divest from the world, to retreat into the safety of dead languages and books. For Griffin, it was a rallying call.
I have to, said Griffin. Otherwise, you're right. Otherwise, we've got nothing.
After that conversation, Griffin seemed to have decided Robin wasn't about to betray the Hermes Society, for Robin's assignments vastly increased in number. Not all of his missions involved theft. More often, Griffin made requests for materials, etymological handbooks, grammatica pages, orthography charts, which were easily acquired, copied out, and returned without drawing attention. Still, he had to be clever with when and how he took the books out, as he'd attract suspicion if he kept sneaking away materials unrelated to his focus areas. One time, Ilse, the upperclassman from Japan, demanded to know what he was doing with the old German grammatica, and he had to stammer out a story about pulling the title by accident in the course of trying to trace a Chinese word back to Hittite origins. No matter that he was at the entirely wrong section of the library, Ilse seemed ready to believe he was simply that dim. By and large, Griffin's requests were painless. It was all less romantic than Robin had imagined, and perhaps hoped for. There were no thrilling escapades or coded conversations spoken on bridges over running water. It was all so mundane. The great achievement of the Hermes Society, Robin learned, was how effectively it rendered itself invisible, how completely it concealed information even from its members. If one day Griffin disappeared, then Robin would be hard-pressed to prove to anyone the Hermes Society ever existed, except as a figment of his imagination. He often felt that he wasn't a part of a secret society at all, but rather of a large, boring bureaucracy that functioned with exquisite coordination. Even the thefts became routine. Babel's professors seemed wholly unaware that anything was being stolen at all. The Hermes Society took silver only in amounts small enough to mask with some accounting trickery. For the virtue of a humanities faculty, Griffin explained, was that everyone was hopeless with numbers.
Playfair would let entire crates of silver disappear if no one checked him, he told Robin. Do you think he keeps tidy books? The man can barely add figures in two digits.
Some days, Griffin did not mention Hermes at all, but instead spent the hour it took to reach Port Meadow and back inquiring about Robin's life at Oxford, his rowing exploits, his favourite bookshops, his thoughts on the food in Hall and in the Buttery. Robin answered cautiously. He kept waiting for the ball to drop, for Griffin to spin this conversation into an argument, for his own preference for plain scones to become the proof of his infatuation with the bourgeoisie. But Griffin only kept asking. And gradually, it dawned on Robin that perhaps Griffin just missed being a student.
I do love the campus at Christmas time, said Griffin one night. It's the season when Oxford leans most into the magic of itself.
The sun had set. The air had gone from pleasantly chilly to bone-cuttingly cold, but the city was bright with Christmas candles, and a light trickle of snow floated down around them. It was lovely. Robin slowed his pace, wanting to savour the scene, but Griffin, he noticed,
was shivering madly. Griffin, don't... Robin hesitated. He didn't know how to ask politely. Is that the only coat you have? Griffin recoiled like a dog rising on its hackles.
Why?
It's just... I've got a stipend. If you wanted to buy something warmer...
Don't patronize me.
Robin regretted instantly that he'd ever brought it up. Griffin was too proud. He could take no charity. He could not even take sympathy.
I don't need your money.
Suit yourself, said Robin, wounded. They walked for another block in silence. Then Griffin asked, in an obvious attempt at an olive branch,
What's on for Christmas?
First, there'll be dinner in hall.
So, endless Latin prayers, rubber goose, and a Christmas pudding that's indistinguishable from pig slop. What's really on?
Robin grinned. Mrs. Piper has some pies waiting for me in Jericho.
Steak and kidney.
Chicken and leek. My favourite. And a lemon tart for Letty. And a chocolate pecan dessert pie for Rami and Victoire.
Bless your Mrs. Piper, Griffin said.
The professor had some frigid crone named Mrs. Peterhouse in my time. Couldn't cook to save her life. No, but always remembered to say something about half-breeds whenever I was in earshot.
He didn't like that either, though. I suppose that's why he let her go.
They turned left on the corn market.
They were very near the tower now, and Griffin seemed fidgety. Robin suspected they would soon part ways.
Before I forget...
Griffin reached into his coat, pulled out a wrapped parcel, and tossed it at Robin.
I got you something.
Surprised, Robin pulled at the string.
A tool? Just a present. Merry Christmas.
Robin tore away the paper, which revealed a lovely, freshly printed volume.
You said you liked Dickens,
said Griffin.
I just bound the serialization of his latest. You might have already read it, but I thought you'd like it all in one piece.
He'd bought Robin the 3-volume set of Oliver Twist. For a moment, Robin could only stammer. He hadn't known they were exchanging gifts. He hadn't bought anything for Griffin. But Griffin waved this off.
That's all right, I'm older than you. Don't embarrass me.
Only later, after Griffin had disappeared down Broad Street, coat flapping around his ankles, would Robin realize this selection had been Griffin's idea of a joke. Come back with me, he almost said when they parted. Come to Hall. Come back and have Christmas dinner. But that was impossible. Robin's life was split into two, and Griffin existed in the shadow world, hidden from sight. Robin could never bring him back to Magpie Lane. Could never introduce him to his friends. Could never, in daylight, call him brother.
Well, Griffin cleared his throat. Next time then.
When will that be?
Don't know yet.
He was already walking away, snow filling in his footsteps.
What's your window?
On the first day of Hillary term, the main entrance to Babel was blocked off by 4 armed policemen. They appeared to be engaged with someone or something inside. Though, whatever it was, Robin could not see over the crowd of shivering scholars.
What's happened?
Rami asked the girls.
They're saying it was a break-in, said Victoire. Someone wanted to pilfer some silver, I suppose.
So what? The police were here at precisely the right time?
Asked Robin.
He set off some alarm when he tried to get through the door,
said Letty.
And the police, I think, came quickly.
A 5th and 6th policeman emerged from the building, dragging the man Robin assumed was the thief between them. He was middle-aged, dark-haired, bearded, and dressed in very grimy clothes. Not Hermes, then, Robin thought with some relief. The thief's face was contorted in pain, and his moans floated over the crowd as the police pulled him down the steps towards a waiting cab. They left a streak of blood on the cobblestones behind them.
He's got about 5 bullets in him.
Anthony Ribbon appeared beside them. He looked like he might vomit.
Nice to see the wards are working, I suppose.
Robin balked.
Wards did that?
The tower's protected by the most sophisticated security system in the country, said Anthony.
It's not just the Grammaticas that are guarded.
There's about £500,000 worth of silver in this building,
and only spindly academics around to defend it.
Of course the doors are warded.
Robin's heart was beating very quickly. He could hear it in his eardrums.
By what?
They never tell us the match pairs. They're very private about it. Playfair updates them every few months, which is about as often as someone attempts a theft.
I must say, I like this set much better. The last set tore gaping wounds in the trespasser's limbs using ancient knives rumored to be from Alexandria.
It got blood all over the inside carpet.
You can still see the brown spots if you look carefully.
We spent weeks guessing which words Playfair used, but no one's been able to crack it. Victoire's eyes follow the departing cab.
What do you think will happen to him?
Oh, he'll probably be on the first ship to Australia, said Anthony, provided he doesn't bleed out on the way to the police station.
Routine pickup, said Griffin. In and out. You won't even see we're there. The time is a bit tricky, though, so be on call all night. He nods Robin's shoulder. What's wrong?
Robin blinked and glanced up.
You look spooked.
I just...
Robin deliberated for a moment, then blurted.
You know about the wards, right?
What?
We saw a man break in this morning, and the wards, they triggered some sort of gun, and it shot him full of bullets.
Well, of course.
Griffin looked puzzled.
Don't tell me that's news to you. Babel's got ridiculous wards.
Didn't they rub that into your faces during the first week?
They've updated them, though. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They can tell when a thief's walking through now.
The bars aren't that sophisticated, Griffin said dismissively.
They're designed to discriminate between students, their guests, and strangers to the Institute. What do you think would happen if the trap sprang on a translator who needed to take some bars home overnight? Or someone bringing his wife to the faculty without first clearing it with Playfair?
You're completely safe.
But how do you know?
Robin sounded more petulant than he'd intended. He cleared his throat, tried to deepen his voice without being obvious about it.
You didn't see what I saw. You don't know what the new match pairs are.
You're in no danger.
Yeah, take this if you're worried.
Griffin rummaged in his pocket, then tossed Robin a bar.
Wu Xing,
it read. Invisible. It was the same bar he'd used the first night they met.
For a quick getaway, said Griffin.
If things really do go wrong, and you might need to use it on your comrades regardless, it's hard to get a chest that size out of the city unseen.
Robin slid the bar into his inner pocket.
You could be less flippant about all this, you know.
Griffin's lip curled.
What? Now is when you're scared.
It's just...
Robin considered for a moment, shook his head, then decided to say it.
It just feels like... I mean, I'm the one who's always at risk, while you're just...
Just what?
Griffin asked sharply. He'd strayed into dangerous territory. He knew from the way Griffin's eyes flashed, he'd wandered too close to where it hurt. A month ago, when their relationship was more precarious, he might have changed the subject. But he couldn't hold his silence now. He felt irritated and belittled just then. And with that came a hot desire to hurt.
Why aren't you coming on this one?
He asked.
Why can't you use the bar yourself?
Griffin blinked slowly. Then he said, in a tone so level it must have been forced,
I can't. You know I can't.
Why not?
Because I don't dream in Chinese.
His expression did not change, nor did his tone. But the condescending fury seeped through his words nonetheless. Watching him speak then was uncanny. He looked so like their father.
I'm your failed predecessor, you see. Dear old Papa took me out of the country too early. I've got a natural ear for tones, but that's it. My fluency is largely artificial. I don't have memories in Chinese. I don't dream in it. I've got the recall, I've got the language skills, but I can't reliably make the bars work. Half the time they do nothing at all. His throat pulsed. Our father got it right with you. He left you to ferment until you were literate. But he brought me here before I'd formed enough connections, enough memories. What's more, he was the only person I ever spoke Mandarin with when my Cantonese was far better to begin with. And that's lost now. I don't think in it, and I certainly don't dream in it.
Robin thought of the thieves in the alley, of Griffin's desperate whispers as he tried to make them disappear. What would he do if he lost his own Chinese? The very idea filled him with horror.
You get it, Griffin said, watching him. You know how it feels for your native tongue to slip away. You caught it in time. I didn't.
I'm so sorry, said Robin. I didn't know.
Don't be sorry, Griffin said dryly. You didn't ruin my life.
Robin could see Oxford now through Griffin's eyes. An institution that never valued him, that had only ever ostracized and belittled him. He imagined Griffin coming up through Babel, trying desperately to win Professor Lovell's approval, but never able to get the silver to work consistently. How awful it would have felt to reach for flimsy Chinese from a barely remembered life, knowing full well that it was the only thing that gave him value here. Small wonder Griffin was furious. Small wonder he hated Babel with such vehemence. Griffin had been robbed of everything. A mother tongue, a motherland, a family.
"So I need you, darling brother."
Griffin reached out, ruffled his hair. His touch was so forceful it hurt.
"You're the real thing. You're indispensable."
Robin knew better than to respond.
"Keep an eye on your window."
There was no warmth in Griffin's eyes.
"Things are moving fast, and this one's important."
Robin swallowed his objections and nodded.
"Right."
1 week later, Robin came back from dinner with Professor Lovell to find the scrap of paper he'd been dreading wedged under his window. "Tonight," it read. 11. It was already 10:45. Robin hastily threw on the coat he'd just hung up, grabbed the Wuxing bar out of his drawer, and dashed back out into the rain. He checked the back of the note for other details as he walked, but Griffin had included no further instructions. This wasn't necessarily a problem. Robin assumed this meant he should simply let whatever accomplices showed up in and out of the tower, but the hour was surprisingly early, and he realized belatedly that he hadn't brought anything with him. No books, no satchel, not even an umbrella that would justify a late-night trip to the tower. But he couldn't fail to show it all. As the bell struck 11, he dashed across the green and yanked the door open. This was nothing he hadn't done a dozen times before. Open sesame, close sesame, and stay out of the way. As long as Robin's blood was stored in those stone walls, the wards shouldn't sound. Two Hermes operatives followed him through and disappeared up the stairs. Robin hung around the foyer as usual, keeping an eye out for nocturnal scholars, counting down the seconds until it was time to leave. At 11:05, the Hermes operatives hurried downstairs. One of them carried a set of engraving tools, the other a chest of silver bars.
"Well done," whispered one. "Let's go."
Robin nodded and opened the door to let them out. The moment they stepped foot over the barrier, an awful cacophony split the air. A screaming, a howling, the grinding of metal gears in some invisible mechanism. It was a threat and a warning. The hybrid of ancient horror and the modern capacity for spilling blood. Behind them, the panels in the door shifted, revealing a dark cavity within. Without another word, the Hermes operatives dashed towards the green. Robin hesitated, trying to decide whether to follow. He might get away. The trap was loud but seemed slow acting. He glanced down and saw both his feet were planted squarely on the university's coat of arms. Suppose the ward was only triggered if he stepped off? One way to find out. He took a deep breath, then dashed down the stairs. He heard a bang, then felt a searing pain in his left arm. He couldn't tell where he'd been hit. The pain seemed to come from everywhere, less a singular wound and more a burning agony that spread through his entire arm. It was on fire. It was exploding. The whole limb was going to fall off. He kept running. Bullets fired into the air behind him. He ducked and jumped at random. He'd read somewhere this was how to dodge gunshots, but had no idea if it was true. He heard more bangs, but felt no corresponding explosions of pain. He made it down the length of the green and turned left onto Broad Street, out of sight and out of range. Then, the pain and fear caught up with him. His knees shook. He took two more steps and collapsed against the wall, fighting the urge to vomit. His head swam. He couldn't outrun the police if they came. Not like this. Not with blood dripping down his arm and black creeping at the edges of his vision.
"Focus."
He fumbled for the bar in his pocket. His left hand was slippery, dark with blood. The very sight set off another wave of vertigo.
"Wuxing,"
he whispered frantically, trying to concentrate, to imagine the world in Chinese. He was nothing. He was formless. Invisible. It didn't work. He couldn't make it work. He couldn't switch modes to Chinese when all he could think about was the awful pain.
"Hey there! You! Stop!"
It was Professor Playfair, Robin flinched, prepared for the worst, but the professor's face creased into a warm, concerned smile.
Oh, hello, Swift. Didn't realize that was you. Are you quite all right? There's a ruckus on at the building.
Professor, I... Robin hadn't the faintest clue what to say, so he decided it was best just to babble. I don't... I was...